next.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. All our lives, we are told how to behave, what's good and what's bad. It's usually the parents and the siblings, the teachers and the preachers who are there to set that moral compass to let us know what's right and what's wrong. Their guidance, they tell us, comes from holy books and founding documents, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. The moral compass settings are supposed to be self-evident, paving a path towards such rights as life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. No quarrels here, not yet. These are, in a sense, definitions of citizenship. Except when certain Americans start telling certain other Americans that their own definition of life and liberty and happiness is supposed to work for everyone. And when Patrick Buchanan declares that this country is a moral sewer and a cultural wasteland that is not worth living in, Dan Savage disagrees. Who are those on the right, he asks, who are going to tell the whole country how to live their lives? And with that question in mind, the sex columnist sets off on a savage quest to explore the seven deadly sins and debunk the moral scolding squad. So our question this hour is, who gets to set the rules? Are people allowed to define their own right to pursue happiness, or does America need direction in the form of censorship and laws? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us from a studio in Seattle is the internationally syndicated sex columnist and author of Skipping Towards Gomorrah, The Seven Deadly Sins in the Pursuit of Happiness in America, Dan Savage. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how are you, Dick?
I'm fine. Nice to have you back on the program.
Nice to be back.
I'm guessing that you wrote this book because you got sick of being told what's right and what's wrong by people who you don't necessarily respect.
That's true. I also got sick of no one coming forward to defend the American sinner. The right has so successfully framed the debate as one of virtue versus sin, and I think the debate should be, you know, their laws versus your freedoms. And nobody was sticking up for freedom or for sin as Americans live it. The way the right talks about indulgence, you're either sober or you're a heroin addict, and there's nothing in between. You're either monogamous or a prostitute, and there's nothing in between, whereas most Americans are in the in-between when it comes to vices.
So you set out on a trip.
I did. I conned a publisher into giving me a big pile of money, and then I went across the country and sinned my brains out.
Let's go to Buffalo Grove, Illinois, David and Bridget. And use them, if we can, these two people that you met, as a measure of this, you know, being between the two extremes.
David and Bridget are a very nice, very observant Jewish couple who live in the suburbs of Chicago, and they're swingers. They're not necessarily monogamous. Every once in a while, they go to a swinging convention or a swinging party in the suburbs of Chicago, and, you know, wife swapping is the term that a lot of people are familiar with, although swingers reject that term because it makes it sound like, you know, the men are sort of passing the women around when often it's the other way around. And they're wonderful people. They're actually, I call them Bill Bennett's wet dream in the book. They're very religious. They're very observant. They're very family-focused. They have three children that they're, you know, taking care of. They're active in their synagogue, and they're sort of moral, upstanding people who also are swingers. They're ethical adulterers, I call them. And we don't hear much about ethical adultery in America. You're Bill Clinton or you're, you know, Jerry Falwell, and there's nothing in between. And I wanted to write about ethical adulterers because I've known dozens. I've known a lot of ethical adulterers.
So when you put to David and Bridget the notion that you began with, that in fact there are ways to sin ethically in the country, what's their response to that? How did you hear from them?
How did I find them?
No, what did you hear from them when you suggested to them that perhaps they are an example of the country, of people who are sinning in a somewhat ethical fashion?
They agreed, and I encouraged them, or I asked them, you know, they're not out about their swinging to friends and family, and of course I've changed their names.
Okay.
And a bit of identifying detail to mask them. And they, like a lot of people who are swingers, they're closeted about it. They don't tell people. And, you know, maybe it's a detail about their intimate life that they don't need to share. But on the other hand, they sort of resent the public image and stereotypes about adulterers and swingers as inaccurate. They're not hedonists, and they're not crazy, and they're not doing it every night. It's something they do very occasionally, and with a great deal of restraint and caution and forethought. And yet they won't publicly come forward and sort of dispel the myths about swingers or adulterers. It's sort of a catch-22. They want the myths dispelled, but they don't want to do it themselves.
Well, isn't that the trouble with all of the sins, though, that nobody actually wants to stand up and do it themselves?
No one wants to defend themselves as sinners. And I think people should, because it would actually decrease the harm that some, you know, a lot of people feel they can't come forward about their occasional, for example, and very responsible recreational drug use. Because although, you know, I know that I can, you know, smoke pot once or twice a year without becoming a drug addict, I don't want to, you know, do anything that might encourage someone who doesn't have my self-restraint to do the same, to start experimenting with drugs and maybe be harmed by it. But the irony is that because people aren't out about how to use recreational drugs responsibly, out there, the people who need that lesson that you can use it responsibly, which means using very, very occasionally and under very controlled circumstances, they never get that message. They never hear about how one uses recreational drugs carefully.
But Dan, your own sister Laura says you're a drug abuser for smoking pot once or twice a year. So
my sister Laura says a lot of fool things, that being one of them. You know how siblings are. There's a lot of people, you know, but that's part of the problem. The all public talk about drugs is sort of orchestrated by anti-drug activists with an agenda and people who say, well, so-and-so's addicted. And everyone wants to use addiction as a trump card. They say, well, I know that you can smoke pot once a year, which my sister says to me, but because some people get addicted, therefore pot should never be legal. But people get addicted despite its illegality. The illegality of recreational drugs is nothing to prevent addiction. More Americans are addicted to drugs than people in countries with much more liberal drug laws as a per capita basis. So prohibition isn't keeping drugs away from potential addicts, hardly.
Okay, now let's just take a quick overview of the list here. Lust took you to Buffalo Grove, Illinois. We also had gluttony and sloth and greed and envy and pride and anger, which takes you to Texas.
It did. I figured, because what part of what I was asking in the book of social conservatives, who I hope are reading it in droves, was that, you know, there are pleasures and pursuits that you may not see the point of or the enjoyment that some people get out of them, but you should just extend to Americans who, you know, enjoy things that you don't, the courtesy of saying, well, I don't get it, but if you're not hurting anybody, go ahead. And I thought I should challenge myself and go and sort of explore a right-wing pleasure that I actually would like to see banned, which is gun ownership and handguns, because of the harm they do. And so I went to Plano, Texas and learned how to shoot. I went to a gun range called the Bullet Trap and hired an instructor to teach me how to fire a .22 and a .38 and a .45, and was very surprised to find out that I enjoyed it very much. I was a lefty and an urban kid, lefty, never saw a gun, never held a gun in my life, and then there I am in Texas and shooting one and going, wow, this is really fun.
So, in fact, there was a little bit of pride going along with the anger at the same time as you're standing in the shooting range in Texas.
It's true. The funniest thing that happened was I pick up a gun and they send this target down the range and they say, you know, he says, shoot at the X, and he shows me how to hold the gun and I shot out the X. And he looked at me and said, do you see the B in the lower right-hand corner? There's a little logo that says Bullet Trap. Can you hit the B? And I shot right through the B. And this big good old boy in Texas claps me on the back and says, son, you're a natural. And natural's not something I get called in Texas very often. It's weird, you know, as an adult, you stop finding new skills. You know what I mean? There's a certain point in life where you stop trying new things. And so it was a real thrill to find out that I was a natural shot.
There's a part in the book, where you take the idea of rights and freedoms in reference to gun owners and write about it. Can I get you to turn to that page and read us a little passage from Skipping Towards Gomorrah?
I would be delighted. Shall I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Gun nuts talk and talk about needing guns to protect their rights and to protect the rights and freedoms that all Americans enjoy. But when the rights and freedoms of Americans are under siege, gun nuts are nowhere to be found. I don't recall seeing any NRA members, for example, ever protesting an assault on the free speech rights of Americans by the feds, or the federal government's successful efforts to undermine our constitutional protections against government surveillance and unreasonable searches, their attempts to regulate speech on the internet, limit abortion rights, and ban any public expression that's in any way sexually explicit. Where were all the freedom-loving gun nuts when the director of the Contemporary Arts Center in Cincinnati, for example, was arrested and unsuccessfully prosecuted for displaying Robert Mapplethorpe's photographs? So while gun owners are always saying that owning guns is about defending freedom, the only freedom gun owners seem interested in defending with their guns is their freedom to defend their freedom to own their guns. For a freedom fan such as myself, this seems a little limited. All that firepower, 200 million guns, dedicated to defending just one freedom. Charlton Heston, the actor and president of the NRA, says he cannot stand by and watch a right guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States come under attack. And yet I don't recall seeing Charlton Heston on television complaining about John Ashcroft's recent assaults on, say, attorney-client privilege. If gun nuts want to convince non-gun nuts of the value of an armed citizenry, perhaps they should use their guns to defend all of our freedoms, not just their freedom to own their guns. Basically, I'm calling on the NRA to be the armed wing of the ACLU.
Yeah, good luck. But aren't you also caught in a bit of a contradiction here, Dan, because there's a freedom there that you actually still don't support, and that is the freedom of an American to own a handgun?
But this is what I wanted to explore in the chapter, is my discomfort. You know, Robert Bork is uncomfortable with some of the freedoms that I enjoy. Freedom to have a boyfriend, for instance, and listen to rap CDs, which he would like to ban. And I'm very uncomfortable with handgun ownership because they are so easily concealed and all the violence and harm that guns and this country do. And yet, I'm willing to go there. You know, it is a right in the Constitution, and I guess if there's some way to regulate and minimize the harm, gun locks, for example, and gun safes and gun registration, that maybe we could limit the harm and allow people to own the guns. But I'm never going to be fully comfortable with gun ownership any more than Robert Bork's ever going to be fully comfortable with me. But I'm free to be me, and he's free to be him.
If we look down the list of the people you call virtucrats, Bork and Buchanan, O'Reilly, Schlesinger, Bennett, Limbaugh, that whole crowd, I mean, is there an outside chance that they're ever going to pick up a copy of Skipping Towards Gomorrah and go, okay, let's just see what Dan Savage has to say?
Well, Robert Bork and William Bennett told the Washington Post that they have no intention of reading my book, which is not really fair because I had to slog through all of theirs in writing this book. It was actually reading Robert Bork's book, Slouching Towards Gomorrah, that prompted me to write this book. Believe it or not, I read it for pleasure. I'm Catholic. We do those sorts of things. And it was a line in Bork's book that leapt out at me, where he wrote, Americans should not be free to choose which virtues to practice or not practice, as that would entail the privatization of morality, or, if you will, the pursuit of happiness as each of us defines happiness. Which for Bork is a problem, and for me is not. For me, that's actually the promise of the United States, is we all get to define happiness and pursue it, and pursue our own definition of it, so long as we're not harming anyone else. And I felt like there needed to be a retort.
And this is your retort to their own contradiction, that they can have their freedoms, but also define what my freedoms and your freedoms would be at the same time?
I mean, Bork and Bennett have a right to proselytize and to try to convince all of us to live as they live, if that's what they think is, you know, the virtuous life. Where they tip over the edge is when they want to enforce their morality and legislate their morality, and I don't think they have a right to do that.
Greed, lust, gluttony, sloth, anger, envy, pride, the seven deadly sins. Connection listeners, our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Is there moderation in sinning? We'd like to hear from you. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And in the interests of objectivity, I'm holding in my right hand a new book by Dan Savage called Skipping Towards Gomorrah, The Seven Deadly Sins and the Pursuit of Happiness in America. And in my left hand, Robert H. Bork's Slouching Towards Gomorrah, Modern Liberalism and American Decline. Dan Savage is my guest. Dan, I'm going to read you, as if you need more of it read to you, a little bit of Bork here. It says, he says, The upshot is that American popular culture is in a free fall, with the bottom not yet in sight. This is what the liberal view of human nature has brought us to, the idea that men are naturally rational, moral creatures without the need for strong external restraints has been exploded by experience. There is an eager and growing market for depravity and profitable industries devoted to supplying it. So what he's saying is we've got to have censorship, we've got to have laws, because we can't control our own desires.
And he wrote that long before celebrity boxing. I mean, the irony of that kind of writing about American popular culture is, you know, you look at something as dangerous and threatening and to the republic as The Simpsons. I'm old enough to remember when The Simpsons was held up as an example of American depravity and the collapse of our culture. And now it's held up as this cultural touchstone and this much smarter and more sort of multi-layered work of art than people took it for at first. And there's always going to be art that's shocking or inept or bad, The Bachelorette and The Bachelor, and it tends to fall away. And people have a taste for the high and the low. I mean, the assumption that someone like Bork makes is that anybody who's listening to, say, you know, Howard Stern would never listen to your program. And that's not true. People in American Americans tend to sample from all over the buffet of American culture. And so when Bork obsesses about the excesses, he doesn't recognize that there are, you know, high points as well going on at the exact same time.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mary's on the line. Hi, Mary.
Yeah, hi.
Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm. I had a question for the speaker.
Yeah, his name's Dan. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Dan. I agree with you about the gun rights. However, this Jewish couple that you're talking about, it clearly states in the New Testament that sexual immorality of that nature is wrong. And I just wanted to state that God's law is there for a reason to protect us. If I could just finish just for a second. Those people are hypocrites. I don't think there's anything I don't think you can define them as some type of new trend in the United States. And being a teacher, I also was a former Peace Corps volunteer. I just strongly disagree with you on the idea that we need an advocate for sinners out there. I really don't think we need an advocate, because I see what people's freedoms are doing to our children. And I see it very directly.
Be specific, Mary. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about, you know, all these freedoms that you're talking about, like how they should be protected, especially, you know, sexual immorality as a freedom. I don't think, you know, if you talk about the breakdown of marriage, it's completely broken down. People aren't getting married. People aren't raising their children. And I think when you talk about one Jewish couple in some suburb who, you know, wants to exercise their freedoms, who cares, you know?
Mary, just hang on. I'm not going to cut you off, but I want to let Dan in here.
Well, I don't know how you punish sexual immorality without creating a police state. And what Mary needs to recognize is there are people who are naturally not monogamous, who are disinclined to maintaining lifelong fidelity. And isn't it better that two people who are naturally non-monogamous, who can't be strictly monogamous, should marry each other and find a way to incorporate into their relationship those impulses so that they don't threaten or undermine their relationship? As I say in the book, where adultery is unethical and problematic is where it's grounded and based in lies, where people are deceiving each other. And Bridget and David are not deceiving each other, and they're very close, and they're very good to their children, and they commit adultery with moderation and restraint. And that's why I think that things like people like David and Bridget and the way they organize sinner life need to be discussed, because if you are not good at monogamy, you should be open and honest with your partner about it before you get married, and you should find a way to incorporate it into your life if it's going to be a part of your life, and if you're not natural monogamous, it's going to be a part of your life that doesn't threaten your relationship, your marriage, or the stability of your children's home. And I think that to lump David and Bridget in with people who you know, cheat or go see a prostitute and their marriage falls apart is tremendously unfair.
Well, I mean, there are certain levels of sinning, but if you're saying that they're not first of all, they can't deceive God, because God knows already what they're doing. They can deceive their children. It's a lie. They're living in a lie. They're changing their identity.
They're not living a lie.
They have a sex life. They're practicing Jews. They are not.
You have no right to sit in judgment of these people.
Right.
You don't.
God does. And it's simply said in the Bible. It's very clear.
God does not live in Milwaukee, and God's name is not Mary.
It's been passed down.
And there's a lot. There's a lot in the Bible that we ignore: the ban on lobster, the ban on shaving our legs, the ban on cheeseburgers, stoning adulterers. That's right there in the Bible. God says, "Go stone adulterers." We don't do that anymore. Otherwise, Ronald Reagan would have been stoned before he'd been president. And it's unfair and terribly selective of you to pick certain things out of the Bible to throw at people. And David and Bridget have a right to construct their private lives how they see fit, and they have a right, and they've wrestled with the moral implications and the religious implications of what they do, and I write about that in my book, and they have a right to find their own way and blaze their own path, and nothing they're doing is compelling you to commit adultery, ethically or otherwise.
Let's bring Anne into the conversation. Anne's calling from Boston. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, you know, I'm hearing this woman, and she does represent a lot of people, but I think it's interesting how she's saying she was a former Peace Corps volunteer and a teacher, as if that sets her above the rest.
She's still with us, so just go ahead and talk to her.
Okay,
Anne.
Mary, you know, I mean, I think I was a Peace Corps volunteer too, so we have something in common. What we disagree on is the fact that I really think adult people, have a right to do what they want within limits. Of course, you can't go out and murder people. There are certain things that are wrong because of the society. But as far as how you conduct your personal life, I think that's up to the individual, because if you believe in God or higher power or whatever you want to say, each individual has to atone for their sins. And so I don't want anybody telling me what I can and can't do, and I don't want any institutions telling me out of guilt or fear of the afterlife or whatever that I can't live my life the way I want. I'm a responsible adult. I will take responsibility for whatever it is I do, and if there is something at the end of the road, I'm the one that's going to have to stand up and talk about what I did.
And let me just step in here if I can. Mary did, in fact, hang up. So I've got a question for you, and it comes from something that Dan was saying earlier in the program, and that is, do you think that as someone who will set her own moral standards, that you have something of an obligation to stand up and tell the Bourques and Bennetts and Buchanans that they're not speaking for you and shouldn't pretend to?
I have stood up in the past. I marched on Washington for pro-choice. I talk about it in my life. I mean, I grew up in the Boston area, and Boston is a very conservative Irish Catholic area, and people know my views. I think I live it. Do I have to stand up to it? You know, I will write letters to Congress if there's something going on.
Right.
I'll go to something if I feel strongly enough about it. But I think the difference is I live it. I don't carry a flag or wave a banner saying, you know, this is what I do. But I think I live it, and I take responsibility. And by the way, I don't tell anybody, you have to live by my standards. That is so archaic. It's something that maybe people are afraid to take responsibility for themselves. I don't know what it's about. I've tried to figure
it out. Let me ask Dan about that, because you actually made it through all those books, and I'm curious to know if you figured out what it is about America today that allows people the place to say these are the standards that this country should live by.
Well, there are people who worry on the right and conservatives that sort of the loosening of and the changing of mores and things in America means and the broadening definition of freedom and rights means that we've lost any sort of grounding or moral compass, and that's not true.
But haven't those people always been there, Dan?
They have always been there, and they've always been wrong. I mean, basically, social conservatives have been saying, you know, we can't give women the vote. The sky will fall. We can't, you know, we can't integrate. The sky will fall. We can't let gay people come out of the closet. The sky will fall. We can't let gay people get married. The sky will fall. We can't have abortion rights. The sky will fall. And the sky never falls. And people, all these things that we were told would, you know, destroy American society or undermine our values or our culture or destroy religion, haven't. And we need to start calling them on that. And, you know, we get the Chicken Little stuff now, mostly about gay marriage from social conservatives, as if gay marriage somehow is going to, you know, convince straight people that they shouldn't be married, which is what the argument against gay marriage is. It'll undermine straight marriages, and I'm not exactly sure how.
Anne, thanks for your call. We're going to Sister Bay, Wisconsin now. Zach's joining us. Hi, Zach.
Hey, Dick.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I just want to say that this is a great, great thing to wake up to. And Dan Savage, I've been reading you, your column in The Onion for years, and it's just an honor to have a chance to talk with you.
Oh, thanks. Jeez. You're too easily impressed there in Wisconsin.
Well, you know, we do what we can. Comment and a question. I'm a gun owner, I've owned guns since I was 14, but I'm also, I consider myself to be socially liberal. I've stood up for, in numerous political debates with my friends, abortion rights and just about every other cause that you can mention. So my question is, are you advocating tolerance of other people's ideas or acceptance?
Well, you can't. I mean, to accept all other people's ideas mean you're not allowed to have any ideas of your own, and it's impossible to accept contradictory ideas.
Well, not necessarily accepting them in that you believe in them, but accepting them saying, okay, I guess I like that idea, or whereas tolerance saying, yeah, you can do what you want, just, you know,
I'm all for tolerance. A multi-ethnic, pluralistic, multi-religious society like ours requires tolerance. Tolerance is the fiber that holds this country together. And of course I'm all for tolerance. I'm only intolerant of intolerance and intolerant of people who would attempt to impose their values on everyone else.
Zach, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Dan, let me ask you about, where are we now? Here, Pride, Jake and Kevin. Because this was a chapter that you wrote about the gay community's embracing of gay pride as something which may be more of a problem. And I read it and thought to myself, we're going to lose some friends, make some enemies with this.
Yeah, the gay papers didn't really like the gay pride chapter in this book.
In a nutshell, tell our listeners what you're saying there.
Well, I think pride as a rallying cry for gays and lesbians is outdated and has become harmful. Whereas Pride 40 years ago had some real meaning, because 40 years ago, you know, there wasn't Will and Grace, there wasn't, you know, you were still classified as sick and sinful, you could still be lobotomized if you were gay or institutionalized against your will and arrested. 40 years ago in California, it was illegal for more than two gay or lesbian people to be in the same place at the same time. So I don't know how exactly they staged musical comedies in California 40 years ago, but or had a restaurant, but it must have been interesting.
But Jake and Kevin say it's for the kids. That's why
kids.
We do it.
Well, 40 years ago, if you came out and you're reasonably healthy, functional, well-adjusted adult, that was an accomplishment, and you could take pride in that. Nowadays, it's much less of an accomplishment to be a reasonably healthy, out gay adult. So what has happened to Pride is it's now, instead of taking pride in your accomplishment of being a healthy gay adult, just take pride in anything gay. Unquestioning pride in anything gay, which has led, I think, in sort of gay urbanarius, this culture of affirmation and moral idiocy, where just, you know, whatever anyone wants to do. See, you know, now I sound like I want to sit in judgment. I do want to sit in some judgment. Whatever anyone does, if it harms someone else, isn't okay. And there's a lot of sort of guys in the gay community giving each other HIV who know it and are doing it on purpose. And I think that's terrible. But gay people sort of lack any sort of ability to call out other gay people on things that they're doing because, hey, everyone should be proud of being gay. And I think that's dumb.
So if you put the word pride next to the word gay, then it becomes something unassailable in the community.
Right. And, you know, we live the rainbow windsock culture and it's not it's not healthy. You know, I don't think, and I say in the book, you know, I don't think common sense is a conservative value. I think that common sense is a liberal value and a sinner's value as well. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of common sense in the gay community these days about, you know, how we're going to organize our lives and live our lives. And I say that in the Pride chapter, which I think a lot of gay people are surprised to see, because gay people who read books by gay people, we usually expect them to be, you know, rah, 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 isn't gay great? And there'd be very little self-criticism. Whereas, you know, you read books by straight people and they're often very critical of straight culture, straight society, straight marriage. There's a lot of sort of debate about what's good, what's bad, what's up, what's down. And you don't get that in gay land. You get, hey, it's great to be gay, or hey, isn't it terrible what the straight people are doing to us? And isn't it great to be gay? And there's some things that are screwed up. And pride is one of them. Pride sends the wrong message to young gay people. And at pride parades, you go and you hear messages like, you're gay and lesbian brothers and sisters, and, you know, we're a community and a big happy family. And that's just not true. We don't tell 15-year-old straight girls that adult straight men are their brothers. We tell them that adult straight men are dangerous, right. And adult straight men who pay attention to you, you have to be wary around because they probably don't have the best of intentions. And yet we, gay communities, gay magazines, gay pride parades, tell gay teenagers that, hey, adult gay people are your friends and your brothers, and they consequently let their guard down around adults, and they shouldn't. any more than a 15-year-old straight girl should let her guard around down around 40-year-old straight men who are paying attention to her.
I can't help but think, though, Dan, that there are lots of people who want other people to set their moral compass for them, that there are people who want
works. And they don't lack for options. They can, you know, march themselves down to a church, march themselves to a Scientology center if they want that kind of direction. The country doesn't lack for people who want to give you moral direction. Go to the bookstore and see all the books by the Dr. Lauras and the self-help gurus and the Deepak Chopras. What I argue in the book is, you know, the big difference between, you know, the church on the corner that wants to give you moral direction and the strip club a couple of blocks away is that the strip club's not trying to close the church down. Sinners and people who pursue sin and enjoy vices, who may also be churchgoers, as in David and Bridget's case, aren't trying to remove options for people who want moral direction.
And so, have you sent a copy of the book to Bork?
You know, I haven't. I figure he makes a lot more money than I do, and he can get on Amazon and order himself a copy if he cares to.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is Dan Savage. His new book is called Skipping Towards Gomorrah, The Seven Deadly Sins and the Pursuit of Happiness in America. The pursuit of happiness, of course, comes from the Declaration of Independence, not the strip club on the corner just down the street from the church, although that may be where you go to pursue happiness. We'd like to hear from you about whether or not there are too many rules and too many people telling us what we ought to do. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WB.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio in Seattle, Dan Savage. His new book's called Skipping Towards Gomorrah. It's a bit of a takeoff on Robert H. Bork's Slouching Towards Gomorrah. This one's about the seven deadly sins in the pursuit of happiness in America. Let's start in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve's been waiting on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good afternoon.
Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks. I'm calling to comment that Ben Franklin was certainly skipping towards Gomorrah, and yet when it came to religious institutions and faith, felt that it had utility to basically keep the masses in line. I'm wondering if that sort of paternalistic utilitarian view of faith and religion is still relevant.
Well, it's very relevant to Robert Bork, who in his book decries affluence and says that the rising affluence and wealth in America has undermined religion, and yet he's opposed to, you know, taxing the wealthy, which would somehow make them more religious, maybe if they were less affluent. And the reason, you know, church has been, religion has been, you know, called out as a mode of social control for centuries, and there's a reason why, you know, during the French Revolution, they ran around sacking churches and killing priests because they were seen as, you know, keeping the working class and the poor in line and a tool of the state. And so, you know, that's, I think, a true interpretation. So long as religion and the state are merged, I don't think religion is necessarily harmful. Often as practice, it's harmful. Let's not forget that it was religious people who flew planes into the World Trade Center. And you hear from people like Bork and Bennett and Bush and Ashcroft that religion is the solution to all of our problems and that religion is, you know, all peace and light and glory. And that's not often the case. Although, you know, my friends who are atheists who say, you know, an atheist never did anything like that. There's only one two-word answer to that is Joseph Stalin. There's something about irreligiosity that or a lack of religion that necessarily makes a person virtuous either.
So what do you think, Steve? Is there a place for religion?
I guess I have concerns about the some of the extreme impulses and some of the limitations that it's putting on our society now. For example, some of the rights infringement and especially in a new time when it's put limits on important ways to help people like stem cell research. So I myself have concerns about it, but I still have this fundamental question. I mean, Dan seems like a smart person. I feel like a smart person who has self-control, but I wonder, it's an interesting time for us because it's not a lot of religious faith is being undermined by new knowledge, and so it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in the new century.
I grew up Catholic and was went to a seminary and contemplated being a priest for about 11 seconds before I came to my senses. And it seems to me that just the huge number of religions undermines religion itself, that there's so many different approaches. However, you know, I read a great quote once from a rabbi that said that, you know, the religious man has to explain the existence of evil and the non-religious man has to explain everything else. We don't know how the world exists, where the universe ends. And I think ultimately that what people need to get to is acknowledging what can't be known. You know, we don't know if there's a God. We don't know that there isn't a God. So let's start pretending we do know and focus on not harming each other and not harming the planet too much. I think that's really, you know, do unto others as you haven't done unto you is a sentiment that I think, if we all hewed to, we would live in a more peaceful, just world, you know? We wouldn't see cardinal law moving pederast priests around, and we wouldn't see people flying planes into buildings if people could hew to that and leave the rest of it to God to sort out in the end, if there is a God, when there is an end.
1-800-423-8255. Steve, thanks for your call. To Louisville, Kentucky now. Daniel's joining us. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Great show. Thanks for taking my call. Dan, I wanted to salute you, and I'm looking forward to reading your book, partly because I think there is a place for religion. What there's not a place for is reduction, just an attitude of reductionism. And I'm eager to read your book because it sounds like you have really gone out and looked at some of the truths of how people are living rather than pontificating about how they should live. And on that note, I wanted to ask what prospect you see for reconciliation and community among a whole lot of people of goodwill when there's the social bullies that your book seems to be answering seem to find their answers from a source that not everyone shares and that may not even exist. And
well, I
think part of the appeal of that type of discourse is, like the last caller said, there's so much more knowledge about human nature and about human reality, and the great tangled, intricate wonder of human nature is so complex and threatening to some people that they're looking for an easy code to live by. And there are those who are ready to offer it, and apparently compellingly and appealingly to a great many people. And I wonder how people who are more open-minded and simply welcoming all experiences are going to find common ground with those who think they have sole propriety to the truth from a divine source.
Well, I think you can...
I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks
for your call, Daniel. Go ahead, Daniel.
You can respond to people who think they have the sole truth just by saying, it's fine for you to think that. I often a problem for, I think, lefties is they want to talk social conservatives or religious people out of their conservatism or out of their religious beliefs rather than saying to them, more power to you, believe what you like to believe, live your life by your own light, and you know, if you believe that two men shouldn't be married, by all means, Mr. Bork, don't marry a man. However, extend to me the courtesy to do the same, to live by my own light, so long as I'm not hurting you, you're not hurting me. You know, believing you've got the objective truth is fine. Be content that you're going to heaven and I'm going to hell, and don't try to impose your objective truth to me on me here on earth, because it's always a recipe for disaster. And if we, you know, social conservatives and very religious people aren't irrational and they're not insane. And if we, and if lefties would start arguing with them about live and let live and do no harm instead of saying, you know, there is no God, and gay is good, you know, instead of saying there might not be, just let them think what they want to think.
But part of it is truth. The part of it is the issue of truth when you write about it, because you talk about the that series of ads that came out from Washington sometime, I guess about a year ago, saying, you know, if you smoke a joint, you're funding a terrorist somewhere, that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, which is a lie about marijuana, because
right.
the vast majority of marijuana is grown in North America, and a lot of it's grown in British Columbia, and there aren't a lot of Al-Qaeda cells.
But in answer to Daniel's question, then, isn't that a part of the measure, though, is figuring out what's true and what's not?
Well, yeah, objective, verifiable truths. You know, if the government, if the drug czar wants to tell lies about drugs, he should be called out on that. When the drug czar says, you know, there's a God and he's coming back, you can say, well, okay, you can believe that, Robert Bork and Mr. Bennett and Dr. Laura and the rest of us can, or some of us can think differently. We're not doing each other any harm by thinking differently. But the government's doing harm when it tells lies about drugs.
1-800-423-8255. Dan Savage is my guest, and joining us now from Boston is Gene. Hi, Gene.
Hi, this is a very interesting conversation. I'm calling sort of with a twist. I'm actually a healthcare professional or nurse, and I also teach nurses coming into the profession. And I'm always sort of appalled about sort of people's lack of understanding of what goes on there among, quote, normal people, unquote, whether that's sexual behavior, drug use, things like that. And it winds up really sort of affecting what we think's the questions we can ask if you're a healthcare professional. I mean, the idea that we had a patient once who was in his 50s, was using cocaine, wound up with some really bad side effects. And the idea with my students that someone in their 50s would use a drug was so alien to them. And it's quite normal. And things like the idea that someone might be going to a prostitute or even, you know, going to swingers, they may need information from their healthcare professionals that they can't go to them about, that their healthcare professionals won't ask them about, and because they look sort of normal on the outside, whether that's a suburban couple or what, there's just an assumption that they won't engage in this sinful behavior.
So what you're saying, Gene, is that Dan is actually right in pointing us towards this middle ground, a place where you can actually talk about recreational drug use or
well, I think he's right. I mean, really right, and I think more importantly, I think, you know, I feel sometimes either I have much more interesting friends than everybody else does, because when people talk about open relationships or drug use, I'm like, yeah, I know someone who does that, and they're, you know, they hold down a job and they have a house, and there must be other people out there that have friends that do this, and maybe their friends just don't talk to them about it. And what, you know, I don't understand why there's sort of this level of denial in society.
Earlier,
this happens and it's normal.
Go ahead, Dan.
Earlier in the show, you, Dick, said that you asked the question rhetorically, is there moderation in sinning? And there is. And that is the way the vast majority of Americans and people over the world sin. You know, my sister deals only with people who are addicted to drugs. So her perspective on drugs is completely colored by that. She thinks you use drugs, you get addicted, and you wind up in her office. Whereas the vast majority of Americans who use drugs aren't harmed by it or do it very occasionally. Yes, there are side effects. Yes, drugs are hard on your system. So is bacon. So are cheeseburgers, as we're seeing in America. And so you need to be very careful and cautious. And if we could have conversations about how, if you're going to use recreational drugs, this is the way you use them without doing yourself terrible harm or without getting addicted, we would be in a healthier place. And all of us, like you were saying, the caller was saying, no friends who are in open relationship or have used recreational drugs or we've used them ourselves or are doing things that we've been told are terrible and will, you know, destroy your life without their lives being destroyed. And we know that what the virtuocrats are saying in public isn't necessarily true.
Gene, thanks a lot for your call. Dan, tell me something. I mean, you knew what you were going to set out to do. You knew that that there were these seven deadly sins that you wanted to go and explore in your travels across the country. Were you surprised by anything?
I was surprised that I was a good shot. I was surprised by some of the places I wound up. You know, when I decided to do, I did for greed, I did gambling. And I wound up in Dubuque, Iowa.
Yeah.
You know, and there's that old joke, you know, well, how will it play in Dubuque? And Dubuque's so conservative. And, you know, and yet here is this this what was regarded as a vice for centuries. You know, Roman soldiers threw dice for Christ's clothes, and that sort of colored the West's interpretation of gambling forever. And yet it's everywhere in the United States now, and it's sort of unquestioned and culturally celebrated. And how did that happen? And it seems to me that that's the trajectory of all sorts of interesting sins, where very good people engage in them and then they lose their taint.
So who gets to draw the lines? I mean, who says that gambling is a legal sin, drinking is a legal sin, smoking dope is an illegal sin, and so on and so forth? I mean, should we be rewriting all the rules or doing away with all the rules?
We shouldn't do away with the rules. You know, when I say that drugs should be legal, I don't think that drugs should be, you know, available on street corners and bins for anyone to come along and grab. We need to have regulations and we need things to be safe. And we need to, restrain people who would do other people harm. Somebody who wants to grow a marijuana plant in his garden and smoke it in his basement while he watches DVDs and eats Cheetos isn't hurting anybody else. And the government shouldn't stand between him, his garden, his bag of Cheetos, and his DVD player. Actually, that's harmful. Kaiser Permanente did a study in which they concluded that the biggest health risk to a marijuana smoker is incarceration.
So should
the 750,000 people are arrested every year for marijuana possession, and they're the biggest health risk is that you're going to be harmed while you're in prison or in a holding tank.
Go ahead. I was just going to ask whether or not you thought the list should be updated. Should we take, you know, lust and gluttony off and put spamming and dissing?
Yeah, spam should definitely be on there, and not using your turn signal, and owning more than one car. There's all sorts of things that should be on in the list of seven deadly sins that aren't. Though one of the genius part of the seven deadly sins is they're so vague and broad, and they're not biblical. They were sort of invented by church fathers because the Ten Commandments were a little too specific. You can get away with a lot obeying the Ten Commandments. And there really isn't a human activity that doesn't fall under greed, sloth, gluttony, lust, pride, anger, or envy. And it was useful for the Catholic Church 1,500 years ago to come up with this list because they could, you know, ban everything.
Dan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Dan Savage, an internationally syndicated sex columnist, author of the book Skipping Towards Gomorrah. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation. You'll find us online at theconnection.org. Click on the forum page. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.